Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
On Commons People this week...
Isn't it time she took responsibility and resigned?
Pressure grows on Amber Rudd over Windrush.
The government's position is clear. We will not remain in the customs union.
Parliament might have other ideas.
Based on the facts, this hearing, and it's fair, I will be exonerated.
And Labour's anti-Semitism problem just won't go away. All of this and more on Commons People. Hello and welcome to Commons People, HuffPost UK's politics podcast with me, Owen Bennett. And this week I am joined by Mr. Paul Waugh. Hello, Paul.
Hello.
And I'm joined by Mr. Ned Simons.
Hello.
All right, wake up. Jesus. Just us three.
Usually you say hello first.
I know, so but it's just us three this week, isn't it?
Yeah.
So sorry about that, everyone. Let's crack on, shall we? The personal stories of those affected by the Windrush debacle are not the only things heaping pressure on Home Secretary Amber Rudd. Labour has repeatedly called for Rudd to resign from her position, and any sense that she had ridden out the storm disappeared on Wednesday when she revealed she was not aware of removal targets for illegal migrants being used in the Home Office. Here's Labour's Yvette Cooper questioning Rudd at the Home Affairs Committee on Wednesday.
Targets for removals, when were they set?
We don't have targets for removals.
But you did.
I don't know, what are you referring
We've
to?
We just heard from the previous evidence that the Home Office and individual, there are regional targets for net removals.
I didn't hear the testimony. I'm not sure what shape that might be in. But if you're asking me are the numbers of people we expect to be removed, that's not how we operate.
Rudd's answer changed from that's not happening to I didn't know it was happening on Thursday in Parliament. Here's a clip.
The immigration arm of the Home Office has been using local targets for internal performance management. These were not published targets against which performance was assessed. But if they were used inappropriately, then I am clear that this will have to change.
So apparently, according to the Immigration Services Union's Lucy Morton, she said the net removal targets certainly do exist. And she said she was bemused as to why the Home Secretary would say they do not. We heard her in the Parliament today, Thursday, saying that she wasn't kind of aware of these, and these were all regional. Diane Abbott's called for a resignation. Is this the final straw? Is Rudd going to go?
I don't know, but I think what has been noticeable is I thought Rudd, whilst under a lot of pressure, had been dealing with it quite well. When she was in the Commons before, she was quite calm and quite firm. But then in front of the committee yesterday, being questioned by Cooper, I thought she seemed really nervous, really didn't handle it very well. I think it was another lesson in sort of why you never want to do anything that kind of annoys Yvette Cooper. Yvette Cooper was so forensic in her questioning that Rudd sort of fell apart in front of the committee and then made that mistake of saying that there was no targets in the Home Office, and of course it turned out there were. And then today, in the urgent question in the Commons, again, I thought she was under a lot of pressure having to admit that she just didn't know what's going on in her department.
Resigning issue, Paul? Surely you should know what's going on in your department. If you're setting targets for the removal of illegal immigrants, you should know about that, right?
You should know about that. Mm. And I would have thought, actually, it does crystallise what is her biggest problem, which is not an individual sort of responsibility for Windrush, which in many ways lies with the Prime Minister. That policy was set by her. But it suggests that if you don't know what's going on in your own department, even if it is one of the world's most dysfunctional departments, famously described by John Reid as not fit for purpose, and still clearly isn't.
Then he split it after saying that, didn't he?
He did, but it's supposed to have got better. But, you know, it's still a massive sort of remit she's got. If you haven't got control of your department, then there is something seriously wrong. And I was really surprised that she arrived at that select committee hearing really not briefed at all. You would have thought beforehand she'd say to the officials, look, give me everything you've got. You know, I'm going to get, this is really important. It's a parliamentary select committee. I've survived, you know, question time. I've survived Home Office questions. I've survived the statement on this. But I want to be briefed even more because who knows what they're going to ask me. And the only conclusion I've got is that that the officials, she must have asked for that briefing, the officials didn't give her one. Why didn't they give her one? Why didn't they tell her how many deportations that, or threatened deportations have been? Why didn't they tell her how many people had been incarcerated? Why didn't they tell her, you know, the level of, the low level question of so-called low-hanging fruit that people had identified. But obviously, but, you know, select committees can throw curveballs at you.
Why didn't they just watch the evidence session that had gone on before Amber Rudd? Well, they came because this question about these targets came up the previous hour.
Yeah.
So why didn't she have someone there? Because surely you'd go, right, hand me a note now of things that, that came up in that session, which that was just poor
But you know what?
Right?
This whole issue of targets has actually been the undercurrent of the entire Windrush saga. Because if you genuinely think that Theresa May's hostile environment has driven this, even if you don't think it's direct orders from a minister, we talked about this in previous podcasts, we think, it, and many people suspect, it's overzealous officials feeling under pressure to deliver. Now, that means deliver what? Deliver a target. And so I'm surprised that she hasn't gone into the department and said, where are the targets? Did they stop in 2015? Do we still have them?
Yeah, I mean, fact that, you know, immigration targets isn't a new thing. We've been talking about the government's net migration target for years. So, you know, it's not the fact that she hasn't known that how they've been trying to reach that target. The Windrush scandal aside, if you've got this migration target to meet, surely if you're Home Secretary, you should be then finding out how it's being achieved. And if part of that is having local deportation targets, why wouldn't you know that?
And I think part of the problem, I think, has been traditionally they've been worried about, you know, papers like The Mail and The Sun getting on their case for the lack of deportations. Don't forget, there's a massive pressure at one point, and this happened under New Labour as well. You know, why aren't you deporting enough people? Part of the reason is we simply don't have decent records on people. And, you know, that's the whole other issue that really hasn't really been approached in Windrush. I hate to say it, but if we did have ID cards, you really wouldn't have had a Windrush scandal, would you?
Labour have been calling for resignations. I mean, they really cranked it up on Sunday, on the Sunday show, Stormbury, McDonnell. They've cranked it up again this week, Jeremy Corbyn and PMQs, heard at the top of the show, calling for resignations. Doesn't seem to have shifted it. Why don't they seem landing in blows on this? I just want to caveat this by saying, when Yvette Cooper asked her question in PMQs yesterday, a lot of the journalists, including me, were like, that's how you asked the question. I thought Corbyn had been poor. And then a lot of people on Twitter, oh, typical journalists applauding the centrists, not praising Corbyn enough. But I think Corbyn's questions yesterday in PMQs were terrible. We kept talking about the atmosphere. Go on, process. Just first question, why shouldn't she resign? Second question, why hasn't she resigned? Keep going on process, surely.
Well, I mean, there's horses for courses in a way. I can see what Corbyn was trying to do, and it was a different job from Yvette Cooper's. And you know, I think what's interesting is that the reaction to the difference between their questions sort of underlines the split in the Labour Party at exactly the time when keep being told on the doorstep in the local elections the party's united. You know, this party's supposed to be, you know, the momentum, people are hanging out with the so-called centrists, the long-term activists, and they're all going out and knocking on doorsteps. So what surprised me is that there wasn't a sort of coordination between a front bench and maybe Yvette Cooper's office. Now, maybe that's just a lesson for going forward, that both of them, they'd need to coordinate. You know, obviously she's got a different job as Select Committee Chairman, but there is, you know, she's a Labour MP at the end of the day, and maybe there should be the leader's officer should be telling her what their lines are going to be, and she should do vice versa. There is the other issue, of course, about Yvette Cooper having been a leadership candidate. Now that's in the background, and people like Owen Jones have already said today, you know, I can't believe the groupthink of journalists that, you know, are ignoring the fact that she was supporting these 2014 immigration bill and she wanted to whip people through it. There is certainly in some bits of the Labour Party a reconsideration of what they did and did it do it wrong. Lord Wood, Stuart Wood, who was Ed Miliband's advisor, on Sunday night said, actually, I admire, looking back, Jeremy Corbyn was right to stand up against this bill and vote against it. And abstaining, which is what Labour did, maybe wasn't the right thing.
But everyone was getting sort of sucked into the kind of UKIP thing at the time, weren't they?
Yeah.
I just want to say, Paul, you mentioned Owen Jones' podcast again. I will never do this podcast again.
Aww. Is that a promise?
Yeah, or it would just be quizzes. I do not want to hear his name. Mr. Ned Simons, why haven't Labour forced Amber Rudd's resignation? In the olden days, she would have resigned, says Emily Thornberry. Why is she still in place? Surely Labour should... This is an easy scalp to get, isn't it?
Potentially. I mean, one reason might be that the Prime Minister's not as strong as normal Prime Ministers would be, and Rudd doesn't want to quit, so isn't being forced out. But also, is the goal to get her to resign? I mean, politically, an atmosphere where the government is looking so both disorganised and incapable, and also so mean-spirited towards migrants that people do want to be here... you know, the more this rumbles on, potentially politically, it's good for Labour to have it carrying on. They can point to how
oppositions
awful the government
prefer
is,
so. Ministers to be wounded rather than dead. Yeah. Let's be honest. And same for prime ministers. If it looks like constant chaos and people still don't quit, then in a way it's a result for the opposition. Don't forget that.
Okay, fair enough. Speaking of things that just won't die, the customs union is back. As we record this podcast, MPs are holding a debate in Parliament about whether the UK should stay in the customs union with the EU after Brexit. It's a non-binding vote and Tories aren't expected to take part, but if some Conservative MPs back the motion, it will certainly put the willies up Downing Street. But Theresa May is clear. Here's a clip.
The British people voted to leave the European Union. In voting to leave the European Union, they voted to leave the single market and the customs union. What we want to ensure is that we as a country are able to negotiate independently, negotiate free trade deals around the rest of the world.
Now, why, for the love of everything, are we talking about customs unions again? I thought, Ned, this was put to bed. I thought we're leaving the A, who, what, when, how customs union. I thought it was gone. I thought it was the dead parrot.
Well, you brought it up.
But like, why are we talking about it again? Why is it back on the table?
Well, because a lot of MPs want us to still be in one. I mean, that's the kind of short answer, isn't it? And they think that we can get one. They think that David Davis, for example, this kind of is related to this, honest. At the Select Committee, he did reveal and confirm that the final deal will be amendable, that the motion to approve it will be amendable, raise the possibility that MPs can vote to send him back to Brussels and negotiate another deal.
Which is a massive change from what's been said before.
A huge change. What didn't get as much attention as I thought it would do, I think perhaps because of Windrush. So the customs union debate today is just, again, I think, them chipping away at the idea that we're leaving the customs union, or there's not another simpler way.
If you're my old mucker Nigel Farage, Paul, and all my old Brexit mates, should you be worried? Should you be worried that this is that Britain's going to stay in the customs union, that Parliament, the MPs are going to have their way on this?
I think they should be worried, mainly because at the weekend, the Sunday Times made clear that actually some people in Number 10 were thinking, look, the parliamentary arithmetic's so tough here. If the Remainer Tories dig in, then there's not a lot we can do. We don't have the numbers. And so they were trying to be pragmatic. Now, I've been told that actually that was officials rather than ministers in any sense, and that was officials thinking outside the box. But, you know, I mean, you can imagine a cabinet minister privately saying, who was neither Remain nor Brexiteer, saying, look, you know, if we haven't got the numbers, let's think about some other solution. And it's the other solution. Like Ned said, you know, amending that motion and the meaningful vote, the only thing really you're going to amend it about is concrete things like a customs union and the single market. You're not going to amend it with anything else that really has got a chance of uniting all the House. And so if you are talking about that, there's this idea, once again, that you're going to have maybe a complicated, complex solution to the problem, and that it's not easy. The good thing about a customs union, in a way, is it sounds easy. But because we will have left the EU, it's not easy to achieve, as well as having migration controls, as well as having other controls. So I was talking to a cabinet minister this week who said, never underestimate just how much complexity our answers are going to have. Whether it's on the Irish hard border, and it's a very high-tech solution, or whether it's some kind of customs union that we're not going to call a customs union. And I think that's the point. It might come down to terminology. It might actually be a customs union, but we won't call it that.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to a source close to the cabinet minister this week, and because one of the things put up was this idea that Theresa May will turn this into an effective confidence vote. You know, if you don't back me on this customs union, then I'm going to have to call a general election. And a BBC kind of ran with this, then Downing Street shot it down. But someone close to the cabinet has said, no, that's kind of how it's being discussed at the moment, that it might have to do it in these kind of terms. I mean, that's a hell of a double or quits from Theresa May, and she ain't that good at double or quits, as we saw last year. I mean, do you think that she's really going to go for that? She's really going to put everything on this vote of back me and we're leaving the customs union when the parliamentary arithmetic says no? I guess she's going to say to Anna Soubry, would you be willing to put Jeremy Corbyn in Downing Street over this?
Yeah, I mean, if they feel that they can't win it, and the only way they can win it is by telling Tory MPs that a vote against it is a vote for Jeremy Corbyn, then she might have to.
It depends. I mean,
under the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, of course, you have to come back to Parliament and all that, and do all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that's why that's why you'd have to call it an effective confidence motion. And there's no question. Don't forget, the longer this goes on, the more we don't have a solution on the table, the more difficult it becomes for the government because they're just running out of time. And you know, it might get to October, probably November, maybe even December before the House of Commons does have this meaningful vote. Some ministers want it to be in January because they think that will be so late that their opponents will be screwed and they would throw the whole thing out of kilter. So it might be December, it might be January. And then the crunch really arrives because say the Commons, people say Dominic Grieve decides that this is such an important national interest issue and gets five or six, seven other Tories alongside
him. Well, I've worked out you need to get, if you take the Labour leavers who probably vote with the government on this, I worked out you need to get 13 Tory MPs to flip.
Yeah, but if, that's why it's interesting making it a confidence motion because it flips both ways. If it's a confidence motion, Labour MPs will be a massive, massive pressure to get rid of Theresa May.
Yeah.
So you can't bank on those Labour leavers. Absolutely. You really can't. And that's why the pressure will still be on Grieve and Morgan and people like that, who are not like Ken Clark and Anna Soubry. We know where they're going to vote. There's no question. But if you, it's the other sort of outer ring of Remainers. How determined they're going to be, we don't know.
Just finally, could Theresa May's pitch be to the Anna Soubrys of this world, not vote for me, vote against this, and you'll put Corbyn in Downing Street. He's vote against this, and you'll put Jacob Rees-Mogg in Downing Street because I'll have to resign as leader, and then who knows what's going to happen? I mean, which do you think would terrify some of these Tories more?
Well, Nigel Farage significantly was backing Rees-Mogg as leader only today in the Telegraph. And I think, I don't know, the difficulty is that still there is little appetite amongst the cabinet to start a leadership race. Although they're all manoeuvring, and we're hearing today about them sorting war chests out, even Amber Rudd, who's damaged goods, looking at some sort of leadership war chest. And Michael Gove obviously keeping his options open. A lot of chat about that. Still, despite all that, I don't think anyone's got the appetite for a leadership contest. The one to watch, I think, is David Davis, because I think David Davis, I mean, he said yesterday he thought he would have failed if the Parliament votes for a customs union. And if you think you've failed, you probably, as a man of honour, quit your post. And if he quits, who knows what repercussions that would have if David Davis quits the government.
Words which we never thought we'd hear about David Davis, but there we go. Let's move on, shall we, now to anti-Semitism. Yes, again, this week the Labour Party was engulfed in a row over anti-Semitism and its handling of the issues around that. Here's Jonathan Arkush, who is President of the Board of Deputies of British Jews, on Sky News with Adam Bolton, talking about the meeting he had with Jeremy Corbyn on Tuesday.
Your position is that Jeremy Corbyn, as leader of the Labour Party, is not getting on top of this.
That is our position, and the evidence that we saw from our meeting, he seems to be unable or unwilling to take control and to take the measures, the minimum measures necessary to stamp out anti-Semitism in his corner of the Labour Party.
It was sort of incredible scenes this week, wasn't it? Because we had Ruth Smith, who was going to give evidence at a hearing of a Labour member who'd been accused of anti-Semitism, having to be flanked by around 40 Labour MPs and peers because of the protests going on outside Labour HQ, saying this was all a witch hunt.
Yes.
It was mad. It was weird. Yeah, she was walking. It was from the video you saw walking along Ruth with his sunglasses on, like some sort of rock star. It was, you know, it was quite sort of a really strange thing to be associated with politics.
And the fact that she felt she needed that is horrendous. Yeah. You shouldn't have to have that support from anyone to go to that kind of event. The fact she felt she needed all that kind of backing. I also thought the meeting that Corbyn had with the Board of Deputies and the, I forget the name of the other
Jewish
group,
Leadership Council.
The fact that they came out with such different statements, the fact that the kind of the Jewish groups came out and said that was terrible, it didn't say anything we wanted, and the Labour statement was, oh, it was all fine. Now, I don't know whether that's because they thought it was fine or they realised it wasn't but thought they'd say it was okay, Paul. The difference was extraordinary.
It seems to me that Jeremy Corbyn felt, if I just going to the meeting is enough. That's the attitude, right?
Well, I'm not sure about that. I think actually it comes back down to how the fact that Jeremy Corbyn is at heart a backbencher. He's not a frontbencher. So he's not used to holding or chairing a meeting and being forceful in chairing a meeting. He's just, you know, he's in his nature. And you hear this about shadow cabinet meetings. He will let everyone say their piece, but he won't sort of lead off as Ed Miliband and other leaders used to. So, and I suspect it, what it seems to me, reading from both sides of that meeting on Tuesday night, is that basically he wasn't forthcoming. He didn't sort of clearly state what his position was. He would sort of, and Jenny Formby as well, they both seemed to talk round some issues. That's what the Jewish groups are suggesting. And at one point, Corbyn was said to have shrugged. And that is, you can imagine the body language whereby he knows these, and he's quite defensive about it anyway. And you can imagine him thinking that he was going to trip up and say the wrong thing, and then absolutely certain that he wasn't committed to it. And so I suspect what happened in that meeting was that he went in or was told, look, here's a set of demands, and then didn't elaborate on them. And also, they felt really frustrated.
And I can imagine there was a report that said he focused too much on process. And Jeremy Corbyn really likes to talk about the process of things. It gets him in trouble a lot. It's actually what got him in trouble when it was claimed he said we should trigger Article 50 immediately.
Yeah.
Now, I don't actually think that's what he said. He was just kind of laying out, this is now the procedure we have to follow. He loves talking about the process of stuff in that kind of old left way. And I can imagine him doing that in that meeting, and that really getting on the nerves.
And to be fair,
rather than saying, okay, I'm going to change the processes, or I'm going to take this action as the leader, like just you say, he's a...
To be fair, I think process, don't forget, is really important.
Sure.
You know, and... But it's not the only thing. And I think we had this blog, didn't we, by Mike Crichton, who used to run Labour's compliance unit. He wrote a very sort of withering blog he wrote yesterday about Labour and anti-Semitism. And this is a guy who used to run Labour's compliance unit, basically in charge of the rules, in charge of kicking people out, who was basically saying there is no political will. And this is something you hear quite a lot from staff in the Labour Party, some of whom have left, but some of whom are still there. That actually, this whole row is being dumped on them. The implication is that it's the staff's fault. They're just delaying. These cases should be speeded up, and you know, and it'll be all okay as long as we speed up the process. But the process does involve politics as well as just a hearing. And Mike was making the point, and I've talked to other people in the party make the point, that actually this isn't a legal process necessarily on its own. This is a political party. You don't have a right to a party membership. It's a privilege. And because it's a privilege, you have to adhere to the party's aims and values. Now, that's not a legal term. And I looked up what you can get actually formally expelled for. And the rule is clear. No member of the party shall engage in conduct which, in the opinion of the NEC, is prejudicial, or in any act which, in the opinion of the NEC, is grossly detrimental to the party. That's a really broad definition. And it's up to a leader to make it less broad and say, right, something that's grossly detrimental is anything to do with anti-Semitism. I'm not going to tolerate it. And that can be set from the top. And I think that's where Jeremy Corbyn, in getting bogged down in some of the processes, has had, again, another blind spot on it.
We are now joined by one of the fantastic reporters here at HuffPost, Sophie Gallagher. Hello, Sophie.
Hi.
Who wrote a fantastic piece this week about the reality of raising a family in a hotel room. And it's a really amazing piece. It's on Twitter, it's on our website, I tweeted it out a few times. And it's just sort of extraordinary how so many children are living in hotel rooms at the moment and the kind of life they have. And where did this story sort of come from?
So I think on our team, we'd been speaking a lot about, I think, post-Grenfell and other things. There's been a lot of conversation around temporary accommodation, but we didn't really know what that looks like. So you can discuss it as a policy, but day to day, what does that look like for the families who are living there? You know, children going to school, those kind of things. So I spoke to a few different families, and the one that was the most striking, which is the one that Owen was just talking about, was the Burns family, who, due to a kind of bizarre and extraordinary set of circumstances, ended up living in Premier Inn hotels around Bristol for 3 years. They have, when they first started, they had two children, and then they had three by the time they moved out of these hotels. And speaking to those families and speaking to other people who work with homeless families, I think we started to see this kind of pattern of, although that seems, as I just said, to be like a really the perfect storm for, you know, such a long time spent in temporary accommodation, actually a lot of people are experiencing this. And I think it was kind of two issues came up. One was an issue of temporary accommodation, and the second issue is this intentional homelessness thing that councils are now using, or seemingly using, to try and help them in tackling the problem of finding accommodation for people.
One of the other people you talked about was single mother Naomi in Camden. Naomi's not a real name, but she had her and her three children living in a single hostel room. The kids are all under 18 months old, and Naomi's life was spent on the bed, the only place she could sit to feed the children and change them. I mean, it's just... I mean, obviously, it affects grown-ups, you know, but it affects the children as well. But there must be a real guilt that these people have, these parents have, thinking this is the life I provided, which is just going to make things worse, right?
Yeah, definitely. So I think with Naomi, I didn't speak to her directly. I was speaking through... There's a charity called Doorstep Homeless Project in Camden who've been working with Naomi and many others. And Vicky Fox, who runs the charity, was telling me she has been working with homeless families for 28 years. And when she first started, you'd see families in temporary accommodation for 2 years was exceptional. That was really exceptional. Now she's regularly seeing families with children in temporary accommodation for up to 10 years. Now, if you have children, 10 years is a childhood, isn't it? It's a whole childhood spent in a single room, essentially. Not always the same room, but in a single room. And she was sharing these really heartbreaking stories of children who, when they're at school, they won't accept invites to their peers' homes because they can't reciprocate the invite because they don't want to bring them over because there's nowhere to play and there's nowhere to do homework. And so it's not just a case of, as you just said, about it affecting the adults. Their whole childhood and their friendships and things like that are affected because they haven't got a permanent home. So.
And obviously, you spoke to charities who are helping with this. Have they put forward any kind of solutions? I mean, is it just simply build more social homes? I mean, is it as simple as that?
I mean, when you boil it down, yeah, it is. It's building more social homes. And also, as well, they spoke a lot about the issue of, I kind of mentioned it briefly before, about councils changing the eligibility for being able to declare a family intentionally homeless. So the Burns family, who were the people in Bristol staying at the Premier Inn hotels, Bristol Council said that they were intentionally homeless. Their private rental flooded and they were forced to leave. And then they weren't eligible for emergency accommodation because they were intentionally homeless, according to the council, which this a few weeks ago was declared by the Ombudsman to have been illegal. And they have now been given compensation and a public apology. But as far as the Burns family are concerned, although their story seems unique in kind of the way I've said, like with these set of circumstances, actually, when they were in these hotels, they met other families who were in the same situation. And although that hasn't, that hasn't been acknowledged by Bristol Council and, that hasn't been raised, but they said that they weren't the only ones going through this.
And it's a question of power, isn't it? Because you're really quite powerless in that situation. Mm. And if you are powerless, some people are actually really scared of speaking out. And so we don't know just how widespread the problem is. It could be really even more widespread because people are worried about going public. Absolutely. And I know that people have, certainly charities have campaigned about it and Labour have stepped up their attack line on this. But the idea of hidden homeless, is something that really hasn't got enough attention.
And it seems to me that we talked with the Windrush stuff about how people were putting policies and systems before people. Ned, do you think this is another example of it, isn't it? Of people actually, people fall through the cracks, because they don't fit into this nice little design system by someone on the desk in Whitehall.
And exactly, I think as Sophie mentions about the council kind of changing the rules, they can kind of get out of having to look after people for, I don't know if it's targets or whatever they feel the reason for doing it. It's just outrageous. And again, not seeing the human faces, it's horrendous.
Sophie, do you want to stay for the quiz?
Definitely don't.
By saying that a tweet from a listener, Christine Quigley, who tweeted in to say, "The quiz is not normally my favourite bit of the podcast." I'm annoyed.
Sure. She's on my side.
Listening to last week's Mannix politics quiz made my commute home.
God.
So we have another Mannix quiz.
Did it say it made my commute home much longer?
No, stop. So this week there was a statue unveiled of Millicent Fawcett, of course, in Parliament Square. She became the first woman to have a statue in Parliament Square. I'm going to now see if you know whether these people have got a statue in Parliament Square or not.
Spend enough time there, you should know.
This game is called Statue of Limitations.
And what are the options?
If you could see Owen's face, listeners, he's never been more pleased in his life.
If I say a name and the person is there, Rock of Ages.
Right. Right?
If they're not there, okay, right, cause... get off my stages.
That's what's terrible. That is truly awful.
I needed a rhyme. Okay?
How about statue or stat me?
No. It's written into the scripts. Okay, so I'm going to say a name now. I want you to tell me, has Winston Churchill, has he got a statue in Parliament Square, Sophie?
I know he has one inside, but I'm not sure about outside. Would they double up? Yeah,
definitely
of course
does.
They would.
Yeah, it's a great one with him with a stick and there's a pigeon shitting on his head often.
That's not part of the statue. what do you reckon, Ned?
Yeah,
so that's Rock of Ages. Yeah. Easy. Right, easy, okay.
He was given a great Mohican once by Potestas. Do you remember with the turf on his head?
Edward Smith Stanley, the 14th Earl of Derby.
I bet he has.
14th Earl of
you're
Derby.
Thinking, I know you know about the 13th. But Edward Smith Stanley.
The Derby was named after one of those.
I'm
going to
say no.
Was it?
Yeah. But I'm going to say no because you just tripped it off your tongue so quickly.
No, I don't. I think
you're incorrect. He has got a statue there.
Where is it?
Guys.
Sophie, join the politics team.
It's
find out.
It's in the square. Has Gladstone got a statue there?
I think he does.
William
yeah.
Hewitt
yeah?
Gladstone.
Yeah, I think he does.
Sophie,
I'm gonna go for no.
You'd be wrong. He does. Pitt the Younger.
No.
Prime Minister at the age of 24.
Definitely not.
I don't think so.
At the time that Ned.
No.
Ned.
Ned's not old.
He made that joke about me, but you leave him full alone. No, I don't think so.
Definitely not.
I'm going to go for no as well.
He hasn't. You're right. Get off my stages. He hasn't.
I'm not using the thing, sorry.
Yeah. Cecil Rhodes. The African imperialist.
No, because that was a university, wasn't it? There was a whole row about...
You can have more than one statue of someone, Ned.
No, you can't.
Yes, you can.
One statue per country.
Is Rhodes in Parliament Square? Well,
born in Bishop Stortford, where I grew up,
I genuinely don't know.
Yeah, I know. It's good, though, isn't it?
I'll take that.
Yeah, of course.
When somebody finally gets around to my fucking Wikipedia page, put that in.
I don't know if he is. I know Jan Smut is. There's a statue
there
of him.
There is a statue to Jan Smut.
Do we get points for extra information?
No, we don't. In fact, we lose points.
I'm going to say no. There is no Rhodes.
Cecil Rhodes.
There's no Rhodes.
Get off my stages. There is no statue to Cecil Rhodes.
Because it would have been toppled by now.
A bit
sure.
of a racist. Yeah. So, yeah. Has Henry John Temple, the third Viscount Palmerston? Has he got one?
Palmerston.
Lord Palmerston.
I feel like...
I'm going to say yes.
I was really disappointed about that Shania Twain thing.
What, back in Trump?
Yeah. It was a really good interview in The Guardian.
Yeah.
It was like, this is really interesting and heartfelt. Yeah. And then at the end, ruined it. Anyway, no. To the question.
All right.
I'm going to go yes.
I'm going to go yes.
Yeah, you're right. So you can see now why people were a bit annoyed because a lot of these people I've never heard of. Who's Gandhi? No, I'm joking. I'll give you the
Jan Smuts is the really odd
Smuts
one.
Is the one because Churchill insisted apparently that Jan Smuts had him. He was a former president of South Africa. I think.
He was.
Shall I give you the full list?
Please do.
Because I know you're dying for this.
Oh,
Sophie.
I am.
She's dying.
Looking at the door desperately.
She's dying inside.
Abraham Lincoln, Benjamin Disraeli, Edward Smith Stanley, David Lloyd George, Gandhi, Gladstone, George Canning, Winston Churchill, Nelson Mandela, Robert Peel. Course, Bobby's, Henry John Temple, and Jan Smuts. Jan Smuts. And now Millicent Fawcett.
Who's Henry John Temple?
I did not go that for Palmerston.
Is that his real name?
Yeah.
Oh. Well, that's weird.
The Fawcett statue is good, isn't it?
Yeah, it's all right. I've not seen it yet. I've not seen it in its.
It's Rachel Weirmouth. No, it's not.
What do you mean it's Rachel? Hang on. Whoa, really?
Rachel White Reed. That was a gag.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so it's an art gag, don't worry.
Oh, right. Way over my head.
Straight over
my head.
Yeah,
what's that about? So that was this week's quiz. Statue of Limitations.
Oh, I'm glad I stayed for that.
Yeah. If only the listeners had.
Yay, but thank you for listening, everyone, and we'll see you next week. Say goodbye, Sophie.
Goodbye.
Thank you.